Side 5.
The great thing about Chrome, said Mr. Scogan, seizing the opportunity to speak, is the fact that it's so unmistakably and aggressively a work of art. It makes no compromise with nature, but affronts it and rebels against it. It has no likeness to Shelley's tower in the Epipsychidion, which, if I remember rightly, seems not now a work of human art, but as it were titanic in the heart of earth, having assumed its form and grown out of the mountain from the living stone, lifting itself in caverns light and high. No, no, there isn't any nonsense of that sort about Chrome, that the hovels of the peasantry should look as though they had grown out of the earth to which their intimates are attached is right, no doubt, and suitable. But the house of an intelligent, civilized, and sophisticated man should never seem to have sprouted from the clods. It should rather be an expression of his grand, unnatural remoteness from the cloddish life. Since the days of William Morris, that's a fact which we in England have been unable to comprehend. Civilized and sophisticated men have solemnly played at being peasants. Hence quaintness, arts and crafts, cottage architecture, and all the rest of it. In the suburbs of our cities, you may see, reduplicated in endless rows, studiedly quaint imitations and adaptations of the village hovel. Poverty, ignorance, and a limited range of materials produced the hovel, which possesses undoubtedly, in suitable surroundings, its own, as it were, titanic charm. We now employ our wealth, our technical knowledge, our rich variety of materials for the purpose of building millions of imitation hovels in totally unsuitable surroundings. Could imbecility go further?
Henry Wimbush took up the thread of his interrupted discourse. All that you say, my dear Scogan, he began, is certainly very just, very true. But whether Sir Ferdinando shared your views about architecture, or if indeed he had any views about architecture at all, I very much doubt. In building this house, Sir Ferdinando was, as a matter of fact, preoccupied by only one thought, the proper placing of his privies. Sanitation was the one great interest of his life. In 1573, he even published on this subject a little book, now extremely scarce, called Certain Privy Councils by one of Her Majesty's Most Honourable Privy Council, F. L. Knight, in which the whole matter is treated with great learning and elegance. His guiding principle in arranging the sanitation of a house was to secure that the greatest possible distance should separate the privy from the sewage arrangements. Hence it followed inevitably that the privies were to be placed at the top of the house, being connected by vertical shafts with pits or channels in the ground. It must not be thought that Sir Ferdinando was moved only by material and merely sanitary considerations, for the placing of his privies in an exalted position, he had also certain excellent spiritual reasons. For, he argues in the third chapter of his Privy Councils, the necessities of nature are so base and brutish that in obeying them we are apt to forget that we are the noblest creatures of the universe. To counteract these degrading effects, he advised that the privy should be in every house the room nearest to heaven, that it should be well provided with windows commanding an extensive and noble prospect, and that the walls of the chamber should be lined with bookshelves containing all the ripest products of human wisdom, such as the Proverbs of Solomon, Bertius's Consolations of Philosophy, the apothegms of Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, the Enchiridion of Erasmus, and all the other works, ancient or modern, which testify to the nobility of the human soul. In Chrome he was able to put his theories into practice. At the top of each of the three projecting towers he placed a privy. From these a shaft went down the whole height of the house, that is to say more than 70 feet, through the cellars and into a series of conduits, provided with flowing water tunnelled in the ground on a level with the base of the raised terrace. These conduits emptied themselves into the stream several hundred yards below the fish pond. The total depth of the shafts, from the top of the towers to their subterranean conduits, was 102 feet. The 18th century, with its passion for modernization, swept away these monuments of sanitary ingenuity. Were it not for tradition and the explicit account of them left by Sir Ferdinando, we should be unaware that these noble privies had ever existed. We should even suppose that Sir Ferdinando built this house after this strange and splendid model for merely aesthetic reasons. The contemplation of the glories of the past always evoked in Henry Wimbush a certain enthusiasm. Under the grey bowler, his face worked and glowed as he spoke. The thought of these vanished privies moved him profoundly. He ceased to speak. The light gradually died out of his face, and it became once more the replica of the grave, polite hat which shaded it. There was a long silence. The same gently melancholy thoughts seemed to possess the mind of each of them. Permanence, transience, Sir Ferdinando and his privies were gone. Chrome still stood. How brightly the sun shone, and how inevitable was death. The ways of God were strange, the ways of man were stranger still.
"It does one's heart good," exclaims Mr. Scogan at last, "to hear of these fantastic English aristocrats, to have a theory about privies, and to build an immense and splendid house in order to put it into practice. It's magnificent, beautiful. I like to think of them all, the eccentric milords rolling across Europe in ponderous carriages, bound on extraordinary errands. One is going to Venice to buy La Bianchi's larynx. He won't get it till she's dead, of course, but no matter. He's prepared to wait. He has a collection pickled in glass bottles of the throats of famous opera singers. And the instruments of renowned virtuosi, he goes in for them, too. He will try to bribe Paganini to part with his little Guarnerio, but he has small hope of success. Paganini won't sell his fiddle, but perhaps he might sacrifice one of his guitars. Others are bound on crusades, one to die miserably among the savage Greeks, another in his white top hat to lead Italians against their oppressors. Others have no business at all, they're just giving their oddity a continental airing. At home they cultivate themselves at leisure and with greater elaboration. Beckford builds towers, Portland digs holes in the ground, Cavendish the millionaire lives in a stable, eats nothing but mutton, and amuses himself, oh, solely for his private delectation, by anticipating the electrical discoveries of half a century. Glorious eccentrics! Every age is enlivened by their presence. Some day, my dear Dennis, said Mr. Scogan, turning a beady, bright regard in his direction, some day you must become their biographer. The lives of queer men, what a subject! I should like to undertake it myself.
Mr. Scogan paused, looked up once more at the towering house, then murmured the word eccentricity two or three times.
Eccentricity! It's the justification of all aristocracies. It justifies leisured classes and inherited wealth and privilege and endowments and all the other injustices of that sort. If you're to do anything reasonable in this world, you must have a class of people who are secure, safe from public opinion, safe from poverty, leisured, not compelled to waste their time in the imbecile routines that go by the name of honest work. You must have a class of which the members can think and, within the obvious limits, do what they please. You must have a class in which people who have eccentricities can indulge them, and in which eccentricity in general will be tolerated and understood. That's the important thing about an aristocracy. Not only is it eccentric itself, often grandiosely so, it also tolerates and even encourages eccentricity in others. The eccentricities of the artist and the newfangled thinker don't inspire it with that fear, loathing, and disgust which the burgesses instinctively feel towards them. It is a sort of red Indian reservation planted in the midst of a vast horde of poor whites, colonials at that. Within its boundaries, wild men disport themselves, often, it must be admitted, a little grossly, a little too flamboyantly, and when kindred spirits are born outside the pale, it offers them some sort of refuge from the hatred which the poor whites, en bon bourgeois, lavish on anything that is wild or out of the ordinary. After the social revolution, there will be no reservations. The redskins will be drowned in the great sea of poor whites. What then? Will they suffer you to go on writing villanelles, my good Dennis? Will you, unhappy Henry, be allowed to live in this house of the splendid privies, to continue your quiet delving in the mines of futile knowledge? Will Anne...
And you, said Anne, interrupting him, will you be allowed to go on talking?
You may rest assured, Mr. Scogan replied, that I shall not. I shall have some honest work to do. Chapter 12 Blight, mildew and smut. Mary was puzzled and distressed. Perhaps her ears had played her false. Perhaps what he had really said was Squire Binion and Shanks, or Child Blunden and Earp, or even Abercrombie, Drinkwater, and Rabindranath Tagore. Perhaps. But then her ears never did play her false. Blight, mildew, and smut. The impression was distinct and ineffaceable. Blight, mildew. She was forced to the conclusion, reluctantly, that Dennis had indeed pronounced those improbable words. He had deliberately repelled her attempt to open a serious discussion. That was horrible. A man who would not talk seriously to a woman just because she was a woman. Oh, impossible. Egeria or nothing. Perhaps Gombauld would be more satisfactory. True, his meridional heredity was a little disquieting, but at least he was a serious worker. And it was with his work that she would associate herself. And Dennis? After all, what was Dennis? A dilettante, an amateur. Gombauld had annexed for his painting room a little disused granary that stood by itself in a green close beyond the farmyard. It was a square brick building with a peaked roof and little windows set high up in each of its walls. A ladder of four rungs led up to the door, for the granary was perched above the ground and out of reach of the rats on four massive toadstools of grey stone. Within, there lingered a faint smell of dust and cobwebs, and the narrow shaft of sunlight that came slanting in at every hour of the day through one of the little windows was always alive with silvery motes. Here, Gombauld worked with a kind of concentrated ferocity during 6 or 7 hours of each day. He was pursuing something new, something terrific, if only he could catch it. During the last 8 years, nearly half of which had been spent in the process of winning the war, he had worked his way industriously through Cubism. Now he had come out on the other side. He had begun by painting a formalized nature. Then, little by little, he had risen from nature into the world of pure form, till in the end he was painting nothing but his own thoughts, externalized in the abstract geometrical forms of the mind's devising. He found the process arduous and exhilarating, and then, quite suddenly, he grew dissatisfied. He felt himself cramped and confined within intolerably narrow limitations. He was humiliated to find how few and crude and uninteresting were the forms he could invent. The inventions of nature were without number, inconceivably subtle and elaborate. He had done with Cubism. He was out on the other side. But the Cubist discipline preserved him from falling into excesses of nature worship. He took from nature its rich, subtle, elaborate forms, but his aim was always to work them into a whole that should have the thrilling simplicity and formality of an idea, to combine prodigious realism with prodigious simplification. Memories of Caravaggio's portentous achievements haunted him. Forms of a breathing, living reality emerged from darkness, built themselves up into compositions as luminously simple and single as a mathematical idea. He thought of The Call of Matthew, or Peter Crucified, of the lute players, of Magdalene. He had the secret, that astonishing ruffian, he had the secret. And now Gombauld was after it, in hot pursuit. Yes, it would be something terrific, if only he could catch it. For a long time, an idea had been stirring and spreading yeastily in his mind. He had made a portfolio full of studies, he had drawn a cartoon, and now the idea was taking shape on canvas. A man fallen from a horse. The huge animal, a gaunt white cart horse, filled the upper half of the picture with its great body. Its head, lowered towards the ground, was in shadow. The immense bony body was what arrested the eye, the body and the legs, which came down on either side of the picture like the pillars of an arch. On the ground, between the legs of the towering beast, lay the foreshortened figure of a man, his head in the extreme foreground, the arms flung wide to right and left. A white, relentless light poured down from a point in the right foreground. The beast, the fallen man, was sharply illuminated. Round them, beyond and behind them, was the night.
They were alone in the darkness, a universe in themselves. The horse's body filled the upper part of the picture, the legs, the great hoofs, frozen to stillness in the midst of their trampling, limited it on either side. And beneath lay the man, his foreshortened face at the focal point in the centre, his arms outstretched towards the sides of the picture. Under the arch of the horse's belly, between his legs, the eye looked through into an intense darkness. Below, the space was closed in by the figure of the prostrate man. A central gulf of darkness, surrounded by luminous forms. The picture was more than half finished. Gombauld had been at work all morning on the figure of the man, and now he was taking a rest. The time to smoke a cigarette. Tilting back his chair till it touched the wall, he looked thoughtfully at his canvas. He was pleased, and at the same time, he was desolated. In itself, the thing was good. He knew it. But that something he was after, that something that would be so terrific if only he could catch it. Had he caught it? Would he ever catch it? Three little taps. Rat, tat, tat. Surprised, Gombauld turned his eyes towards the door. Nobody ever disturbed him while he was at work. It was one of the unwritten laws.
Come in,
he called. The door, which was ajar, swung open, revealing from the waist upwards the form of Mary. She had only dared to mount halfway up the ladder. If he didn't want her, retreat would be easier and more dignified than if she climbed to the top. "May I come in?" she asked.
"Certainly."
She skipped up the remaining two rungs and was over the threshold in an instant. "A letter came for you by the second post," she said. "I thought it might be important, so I brought it out to you." Her eyes, her childish face, were luminously candid as she handed him the letter. There had never been a flimsier pretext. Gombauld looked at the envelope and put it in his pocket, unopened.
"Luckily," he said, "it isn't at all important. Thanks very much all the same."
There was a silence. Mary felt a little uncomfortable. "May I have a look at what you've been painting?" she had the courage to say at last. Gombauld had only half smoked his cigarette. In any case, he wouldn't begin work again until he had finished. He would give her the 5 minutes that separated him from the bitter end.
"This is the best place to see it from," he said.
Mary looked at the picture for some time without saying anything. Indeed, she didn't know what to say. She was taken aback. She was at a loss. She had expected a cubist masterpiece, and here was a picture of a man and a horse, not only recognisable as such, but even aggressively in drawing. Trompe l'œil. There was no other word to describe the delineation of that foreshortened figure under the trampling feet of the horse. What was she to think? What was she to say? Her orientations were gone. One could admire representationalism in the old masters, obviously, but in a modern? At 18 she might have done so, but now after 5 years of schooling among the best judges, her instinctive reaction to a contemporary piece of representation was contempt. An outburst of laughing disparagement. What could Gombauld be up to? She had felt so safe in admiring his work before, but now she didn't know what to think. It was very difficult, very difficult. "There's rather a lot of chiaroscuro, isn't there?" she ventured at last, and inwardly congratulated herself on having found a critical formula so gentle and at the same time so penetrating.
"There is," Gombauld agreed.
Mary was pleased. He accepted her criticism. It was a serious discussion. She put her head on one side and screwed up her eyes. "I think it's awfully fine," she said, "but of course it's a little too trompe-l'œil for my taste." She looked at Gombauld, who made no response, but continued to smoke, gazing meditatively all the time at his picture. Mary went on gaspingly, "When I was in Paris this spring, I saw a lot of Chaplitsky. I admire his work so tremendously. Of course, it's frightfully abstract now, frightfully abstract, and frightfully intellectual. He just throws a few oblongs onto his canvas, quite flat, you know, and painted in pure primary colours. But his design is wonderful. He's getting more and more abstract every day. He'd quite given up the third dimension when I was there, and was just thinking of giving up the second. Soon, he says, there'll just be the blank canvas. That's the logical conclusion. Complete abstraction. Painting's finished. He's finishing it."
When he's reached pure abstraction, he's going to take up architecture. He said it's more intellectual than painting. Do you agree? She asked with a final gasp. Gombauld dropped his cigarette end and trod on it.
Szaplitzky's finished painting, he said. I've finished my cigarette, but I'm going on painting.
And advancing towards her, he put his arm round her shoulders and turned her round away from the picture.
Mary looked up at him, her hair swung back a soundless bell of gold. Her eyes were serene, she smiled. So the moment had come. His arm was round her. He moved slowly, almost imperceptibly, and she moved with him. It was a peripatetic embracement.
"Do you agree with him?" she repeated.
The moment might have come, but she would not cease to be intellectual, serious.
"I don't know. I shall have to think about it."
Gombauld loosened his embrace. His hand dropped from her shoulder.
"Be careful going down the ladder,"
he added solicitously. Mary looked round, startled. They were in front of the open door. She remained standing there for a moment in bewilderment. The hand that had rested on her shoulder made itself felt lower down her back. It administered three or four kindly little smacks. Replying automatically to its stimulus, she moved forward.
"Be careful going down the ladder,"
said Gombauld once more. She was careful. The door closed behind her, and she was alone in the little green close. She walked slowly back through the farmyard. She was pensive. Chapter 13. Henry Wimbush brought down with him to dinner a budget of printed sheets loosely bound together in a cardboard portfolio.
"Today," he said, exhibiting it with a certain solemnity, "today I have finished the printing of my History of Chrome. I helped to set up the type of the last page this evening."
"The famous history?" cried Anne. The writing and the printing of this magnum opus had been going on as long as she could remember. All her childhood long, Uncle Henry's history had been a vague and fabulous thing, often heard of and never seen.
"It has taken me nearly 30 years, said Mr. Wimbush. 25 years of writing and nearly 4 of printing, and now it's finished. The whole chronicle, from Sir Fernando Lapeith's birth to the death of my father, William Wimbush, more than 3 centuries and a half. A history of Chrome, written at Chrome and printed at Chrome by my own press."
"Shall we be allowed to read it now it's finished?" asked Ennis. Mr. Wimbush nodded.
"Certainly," he said, "and I hope you will not find it uninteresting," he added modestly. "Our muniment room is particularly rich in ancient records, and I have some genuinely new light to throw on the introduction of the three-pronged fork."
"And the people?" asked Gombauld. "Sir Ferdinando and the rest of them? Were they amusing? Were there any crimes or tragedies in the family?"
"Let me see."
Henry Wimbush rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
"I can only think of 2 suicides, 1 violent death, 4 or perhaps 5 broken hearts, and 6 little blots on the scutcheon in the way of misalliances, seductions, natural children, and the like. No, on the whole, it's a placid and uneventful record."
"The Wimbushes and the Lapeiths were always an unadventurous, respectable crew," said Priscilla, with a note of scorn in her voice. "If I were to write my family history now, why, it would be 1 long, continuous blot from beginning to end."
She laughed jovially and helped herself to another glass of wine.
"And if I were to write mine," Mr. Scogan remarked, "it wouldn't exist. After the second generation, we Scogans are lost in the mists of antiquity."
"After dinner," said Henry Wimbush, a little piqued by his wife's disparaging comment on the Masters of Chrome, "I'll read you an episode from my history that will make you admit that even the Lapeiths, in their own respectable way, had their tragedies and strange adventures."
"I'm glad to hear it," said Priscilla.
"Glad to hear what?" asked Jenny, emerging suddenly from her private interior world, like a cuckoo from a clock. She received an explanation, smiled, nodded, cuckooed a last, "I see," and popped back, clapping shut the door behind her. Dinner was eaten. The party had adjourned to the drawing-room.
"Now,"
said Henry Wimbush, pulling up a chair to the lamp.
He put on his round pince-nez, rimmed with tortoiseshell, and began cautiously to turn over the pages of his loose and still fragmentary book. He found his place at last.
"Shall I begin?"
he asked, looking up.
"Do,"
said Priscilla, yawning. In the midst of an attentive silence, Mr. Wimbush gave a little preliminary cough and started to read. "The infant who was destined to become the fourth baronet of the name of Lepeith was born in the year 1740. He was a very small baby, weighing not more than 3 pounds at birth, but from the first he was sturdy and healthy. In honour of his maternal grandfather, Sir Hercules Ockham of Bishop's Ockham, he was christened Hercules. His mother, like many other mothers, kept a notebook in which his progress from month to month was recorded. He walked at 10 months, and before his second year was out, he had learned to speak a number of words. At 3 years, he weighed but 24 pounds, and at 6, though he could read and write perfectly and showed a remarkable aptitude for music, he was no larger and heavier than a well-grown child of 2. Meanwhile, his mother had borne 2 other children, a boy and a girl, one of whom died of croup during infancy, while the other was carried off by smallpox before it reached the age of 5. Hercules remained the only surviving child. On his 12th birthday, Hercules was still only 3 feet and 2 inches in height. His head, which was very handsome and nobly shaped, was too big for his body, but otherwise he was exquisitely proportioned, and for his size, of great strength and agility. His parents, in the hope of making him grow, consulted all the most eminent physicians at the time. Their various prescriptions were followed to the letter, but in vain. One ordered a very plentiful meat diet, another exercise, a third constructed a little rack, modelled on those employed by the Holy Inquisition, on which young Hercules was stretched, with excruciating torments, for 30 minutes every morning and evening. In the course of the next 3 years, Hercules gained perhaps 2 inches. After that, his growth stopped completely, and he remained for the rest of his life a pygmy of 3 feet and 4 inches. His father, who had built the most extravagant hopes upon his son, planning for him in his imagination a military career equal to that of Marlborough, found himself a disappointed man. "I have brought an abortion into the world," he would say, and he took so violent a dislike to his son that the boy dared scarcely come into his presence. His temper, which had been serene, was turned by disappointment to moroseness and savagery. He avoided all company, being, as he said, ashamed to show himself the father of a lusus naturae among normal, healthy human beings, and took to solitary drinking, which carried him very rapidly to his grave. For the year before Hercules came of age, his father was taken off by an apoplexy. His mother, whose love for him had increased with the growth of his father's unkindness, did not long survive, but little more than a year after her husband's death succumbed, after eating 2 dozen of oysters, to an attack of typhoid fever.
End of side 5.